welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about Mike Pence giving people AIDS. Yes, that's real. Keep listening. And also Mike Pence gutting labor rights, as well as the situation on the ground at the RNC. But before we can move on, the Republican National Convention has been quite the spectacle. They had one day entirely aimed at demonizing Muslims and anyone who condemns outrageous police violence. They had another day that was allegedly about jobs, where almost no one talked about jobs. They have talked about all sorts of other things, though. Ben Carson, for instance, sought to link Hillary Clinton to Satan by noting a dedication in a book written in 1971 by someone long dead who allegedly was someone Clinton looked up to. Let's take a quick listen.
Now, interestingly enough, let me tell you something about Saul Alinsky. He wrote a book called Rules for Radicals. On the dedication page, it acknowledges Lucifer, the original radical who gained his own kingdom.
So, yes, Ben Carson decided to go with the Hillary is a Satanist line of attack. Chris Christie, the former federal prosecutor, decided that he wanted to relive his past glory days as a U.S. attorney and led his RNC jury in the trial of Hillary Clinton. Here's a little taste.
Let's go to North Africa. She was the chief engineer of the disastrous overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya. Libya today, after Hillary Clinton's grand strategy, their economy's in ruins, there's death and violence on the streets, and ISIS is now dominating that country. So I'm going to ask you this. Hillary Clinton, as a failure for ruining Libya and creating a nest for terrorist activity by ISIS, answer me now, is she guilty or not guilty?
I have to say, it's a little rich on the part of Chris Christie to be saying this. I mean, here is someone who wanted the United States to shoot down Russian planes in Syria, advocates the most belligerent attitude towards China, and urges the deepening of U.S. military engagement in Iraq, because, yeah, that worked so well. So again, pretty interesting for him to be holding anyone accountable for disastrous foreign policy. Oh, and by the way, he's promoting a presidential candidate that has pretty openly argued for some fairly disastrous sounding escalations in the Middle East. For instance, destroying huge amounts of the infrastructure in Iraq and Syria to allegedly hurt ISIS. Now, this, of course, would leave those countries' economies in ruin for whoever the next leader is. Just saying. He also made sure to get a little something in on the whole issue of Hillary's email server. Let's listen now.
She said there was no marked classified information on her server. The FBI director said that's untrue. She said that she did not email any classified information. The FBI director says that's untrue. She said all work-related emails were sent back to the State Department. The FBI director said that's not true.
Okay, well, maybe he has something of a point here, but then again, FBI Director James Comey also is one of the biggest promoters of the blatantly false Ferguson effect idea, and who also claims ISIS is present in all 50 states. So, you know, not necessarily an unimpeachable source. And while Clinton may have lied on the whole server issue, Christie and the Republicans are the ones who want access to your server and everyone else's, every piece of data you send electronically, and they want all of that without any sort of warrant. Christie has, in fact, made a point to be the guy who is one of the most aggressively in favor of every spying program the NSA could ever dream up. So if we're going to talk about servers, it seems like we may want to talk about that, too. Mr. Christie decided to just keep moving right ahead, though, and made sure he took a backhanded shot at both Cuba and a hero of the black struggle for freedom. Listen here.
Hillary Clinton supported concessions to the Castro brothers and got almost nothing in return for ending the embargo. She supported a deal that didn't even require this murderous regime to return a cop killer, Joanne Chesimard, to face justice. See, I know about this personally. Joanne Chesimard murdered a New Jersey state trooper in cold blood, fled to Cuba, and lives there under Cuban protection to this very day.
So first, the embargo, also known as a blockade, is not over Governor Christie. But beyond the factual issues, who is Joanne Chesimard? Well, you may know her as Asada Shakur. Christie only uses her birth name to be as derogatory as possible. He also manipulates the story, given that evidence has clearly shown Asada Shakur did not commit the murders that she was charged with. Obviously, the bridge between fantasy and reality is blocked for Christie and all the other Republicans. So what does it all add up to? Well, that the Republicans are basically exactly what we thought they were. They made sure to engage in an unbelievable spectacle of bigotry and racism against immigrants. They celebrated the killing of innocent people by cops and lustily cheered every suggestion of dead Muslims. They filled some hours with crazy right-wing ideas about how to cut taxes for the super rich and make sure corporations can pollute and poison at will. They praised the military and promised to heap billions upon billions upon billions more in their coffers to deepen wars abroad in search of profits for the ruling elite. The issue isn't who is better or who is worse between Democrats and Republicans. Anyone who listens to this show knows the charge sheet against both parties is pretty long. The issue is the absurdity of having a country where one of the two major political parties is a violent, religious, bigoted, homophobic organization that wants to impose its will and its so-called values on every other country on Earth. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we're continuing our conversation today, talking with Allie McCracken, the National Director of Code Pink, who, as many people may have seen on national television on the first night of the Republican National Convention, was escorted out for, as I said on Twitter, bringing a little humanity to that gathering, but as some would say, perhaps disrupting. Anyway, Allie, thank you so much for jumping on with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Eugene.
So the first thing I wanted to get to before we get to the particular situation is just a little bit for folks who are listening here about what the scene has been so far at the RNC. I mean, have there been a lot of protest and things like that going on around and, I guess, inside the convention?
Yeah, there have been some huge coalition marches, some smaller coalition marches. And at night when the RNC is in full swing, there's not as many people as I expected to be outside, to be completely honest. I was actually hoping that the masses would be here knocking down the doors out front, but we see people have really been focusing their energy, it seems like, on movement building and coalition building and a lot of the behind the scenes work. So I'm thrilled to be a part of all this. We've been part of some really awesome marches, and you know, we were doing stuff every hour.
And I'm glad you raised that, because one of the things I've been was thinking in the lead up to this is, you know, right after the situation happened in Dallas, you had Chief Ramsey from Philadelphia, other officials immediately start saying, oh, well, there's going to be violence at the RNC and the DNC and people are going to be shooting at each other. I think Ramsey's exact words were something like, there's no way these two conventions can go down without some sort of major incident. And I wonder, after something like Dallas, which I think for a lot of people was scary and worrisome, if that maybe had an effect and if maybe that was deliberate and maybe suppressing some of the protests, because we know how much anger there is at Trump and other Republicans.
Well, I mean, I have to be completely honest. The marches that I've participated in have all been super peaceful. I mean, there's like a lot of righteous anger, but we haven't seen any confrontations with the police so far. The police are suited up like RoboCops, but they've generally kept more of a distance. And I think that can be attributed to the great work by the ACLU leading up to the conference. The cops came under a lot of fire for how much they were militarizing themselves in the totally insane laws that were being passed banning things like tennis balls from the convention in a city where it's legal to openly carry guns. So I think that they got spanked by civil liberties groups and they're chill, but obviously the week is not over yet. So it's hard to tell what will happen and if things will escalate.
And so I want to go back to the Monday night. I don't know if we could call it an incident. I thought it was fantastic, but incident makes it sound bad. And so I guess just for folks who didn't see, maybe you could just describe the action that you all did, Code Pink, inside of the RNC. I believe it was when Rudy Giuliani was speaking.
Well, there were two incidents, actually, that occurred. The first is that, well, the background information is that my colleague and I just happened to go into the RNC. It was really easy to just walk in, which is ironic, you know, because the GOP was talking the whole time about how they're going to keep America safe, right. But they can't even keep Code Pink out of their own convention. So we'll see how that works out for them. So my colleague and I had gone into the RNC and we're listening to the speakers and they were saying all this awful, hateful rhetoric. I heard cops blaming people, like victimizing victims of police brutality, just saying like really, really awful things. And we were just disgusted. And I felt compelled and spoke out yelling at the top of my lungs when Jeff Sessions was speaking. He's a Warhawk senator from Alabama. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it wasn't just because he was hawking for war, but it was at that moment that Mike Pence, Trump's VP pick, had walked in and he was right near me. Mm. And all the press was asking him a million questions. And I was like, I have got to say something. I can't have this guy right near me and have Jeff Sessions be talking about war without saying that it's war that's making us unsafe, because that was their whole theme, is that they say that the Democrats keep us unsafe because they want to end wars instead of win wars. I think both Democrats and Republicans aren't at all interested in ending wars. Mm-hmm. So then my colleague, I was escorted out after my disruption. And then later Rudy Giuliani was speaking and he started going on about Islamic extremism and how that makes us unsafe. And my colleague Chelsea stood up with a banner that read "Refugees welcome." And she said that the GOP's Islamophobia is what makes us unsafe. And then she was escorted out.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought up a couple of those points, but one in particular, I mean, it seemed like one of the biggest dichotomies to me as well. And certainly this is one of the things that Republicans are making a big issue. I mean, the whole thing around demonizing Black Lives Matter is, oh, the cities are out of control and they're collapsing and, you know, blah, 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 blah. But then at the same time, they're like, let's just spend all our money on, you know, guns, weapons, missiles, nuclear weapons, war. I mean, the whole thing is just war, 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 war. While at the same time, they're trying to say, oh, well, our cities are collapsing. I mean, that just seems like a huge contradiction to me.
Yeah, there's so many contradictions coming out of the GOP. And if you want to look at recent examples, we see that the GOP is trying to blame the recent killings of police officers on the Black Lives Matter movements, when we see in both Baton Rouge and in Dallas, the people who killed the police officers were both former soldiers mm-hmm. in the Marines and the U.S. Army. And I don't understand why the GOP and our country isn't looking closer at how people are becoming militarized when they're joining the armed services and coming back traumatized and incapable of using these weapons that are all over our streets. So I think that both the GOP and the Democrats are militarized political parties that aren't actually interested in investing in our communities, instead have an interest in spending trillions of dollars on war.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of arms in the street, the other, I guess, big controversial issue at the RNC has been, you know, this issue of open carry inside of Cleveland, and both people on both sides of the issue saying they were going to show up with guns. I mean, has that been the case? Are people out there? Is it creating tensions, or in what type?
That's a good question. Over the weekend before the RNC started, there was a Black Power rally and I saw guns there. I've seen a few big white biker guys with guns, and I've heard about threats being made, racial tension between white supremacists and Black Power groups. So that's the like most obvious manifestation of the situation. But it is just remarkable at how absurd it is that the city of Cleveland has banned so many random objects like umbrellas and soapboxes and even tennis balls when people are allowed to carry massive assault weapons hanging off of their shoulders or their hips. So on Tuesday night, Code Pink launched an action in conjunction with the Brady campaign to end gun violence, and we dumped 500 tennis balls right in front of the RNC, calling for a ban of assault weapons and not tennis balls.
I mean, tennis balls of all, I mean, it just makes you like, who even comes up with this? Not that, you know, I don't know who comes up with these. Like, okay, yeah, you got an AR-15, but like, man, we better not let someone in here with like one of those little six things of tennis balls. I mean, that's really, I don't know, it's unbelievable on so many different levels. I mean, I just wonder, you know, also from your perspective, I think, why is it that so much of the conversation, it seems, around what's going on in the RNC and in Cleveland is just about, not really about the substance of the issues, but, oh, the two sides facing off? I mean, why is the media not covering this more substantively, do you think?
That's a good question. I feel like being here, the media is super wrapped up in the drama of Donald Trump's caricature-like persona. I mean, like, that's what they're looking for. They're looking for the drama. They're looking for the stories. And they're not talking about what's on the street. If you look at the sort of protest coverage that's happening here, I mean, we've gotten a lot of coverage because we have been dressing in really outrageous costumes and being super over the top. But I haven't seen very good coverage of the folks talking about issues like gun violence in Ohio or the open carry law. And that's one of the reasons why we did the tennis ball action on Tuesday, is to really force that issue into the conversation. But it seems just like a circus, and Donald Trump is the leading elephant in the ring.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely, that is the case. But Code Pink is on the scene, and that was Ali McCracken, the national director of Code Pink, who, if you look at the feed from Monday's prime time in the RNC, you will see with some other Code Pink folks. But Ali, thank you so much for joining. That's going to do it for our show today. And you were listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation talking about Mike Pence's atrocious, I think that's fair to say, record on reproductive rights. And we are super happy to be joined in this segment by Ms. Erica Sacken, the Director of Political Communications at Planned Parenthood Federation of America, and Ali Bogan, Political and Campaigns Director at Rewire.news. Thank you both for joining.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having me. And just a note, it's a Planned Parenthood Action Fund, actually.
Ah, okay, perfect. Planned Parenthood Action Fund. We will correct that. And so just jumping right into it, Mr. Mike Pence, the vice presidential candidate of the Republican Party in this year, 2016, seems to have been really one of the most extreme politicians, whether in Congress or as the governor, when it comes to attacks on reproductive rights. So I don't know, Erica, maybe we could start with you. If you could maybe tell us a little bit about the bill that he signed into law earlier this year that even some Republicans said was too extreme.
Absolutely. So Mike Pence has actually been leading this crusade against Planned Parenthood and really against access to reproductive health care for almost a decade now, starting in 2007 when he was in Congress. He was one of the first people to talk about wanting to defund Planned Parenthood, which really, when you think about it, means just blocking patients, especially low-income patients, from accessing basic health care at Planned Parenthood. This bill that he signed into law in Indiana, you're absolutely right, was so extreme, a lot of Republicans opposed it. It was actually one of the most extreme pieces of legislation in the country, restricting access to abortion. And among other things, it would require a woman, really during one of the most devastating times in her life, after learning that she had a fetal anomaly, to prolong her pregnancy, even if it was against her wishes, and even if the fetus can't survive outside of the womb.
Wow. And Ali, let me also ask you this, too, because the name of this bill was the House Enrolled Act 1337, H.E.A. 1337, which has to be the most banal name ever given to any sort of bill. And I wonder if that's an indication in some ways, and I could be wrong. And I noticed some of these other, you know, trap laws that are out there, similar sort of things. They try to have these benign or positive sounding names. If some of that is because really, people like Mike Pence are out of step with what most people think about reproductive rights in America.
Laws like this, and especially laws that have, a lot of them, you're right, do have names where you can't really tell what they're about or things of that nature. And a lot of the times they're under the guise of helping women, or they're just about safety standards. But really, they're about blocking access to abortion care. And that's what it is.
Mm-hmm. No, I hear you. And certainly on the same topic, Erica, I did thought this was interesting when I was pulling quotes that Mike Pence called Roe v. Wade, quote, the worst Supreme Court decision since Dred Scott, which for those who don't remember is the decision that said in 1850 1857, I believe, that black people had no rights that the white man was bound to respect. So one of the laws that helped sort of set the table for the oppression of black people in America. So I wonder how you feel with him drawing this equivalence between, you know, this pro-slavery decision and Roe v. Wade.
No, I think that means that he is fitting for Donald Trump's presidential ticket. We already know that Donald Trump has been running a campaign based on racism and sexism and trying to divide this country against, you know, the kind of the folks who are with him and then everybody else. And I think that it makes sense that he's added Pence to his ticket as his second in command and second running mate.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And Ali, I kind of wanted to stick with that because it's been interesting the way I've seen a lot of the mainstream media cover the Pence pick. And the whole thing has been about, well, all right, they needed to get this guy who is a true conservative who could, you know, make the base feel comfortable or whatever it may be. But I mean, I tend to actually sort of lean a little bit more towards what Erica was saying here, too. In my own view is that, you know, the whole reason they added him is not so much to calm the base. I mean, he won the primary, to be honest. But beyond that, to have someone where it's like it's almost a dog whistle, like, OK, our main candidate is going to say all these, you know, just outrageous, misogynist things. And our vice presidential candidate doesn't really believe women have any reproductive health rights. And it really is just sort of a dog whistle approach for a very narrow section of the country that they're trying to mobilize.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. We saw a lot of skeptical anti-choice groups in particular when Trump became the presumptive nominee. We still have groups like National Right to Life that haven't endorsed Trump yet. We have more extreme groups, of course, like Troy Newman has signaled that he, of Operation Rescue, has signaled that he has moved to support Trump. But this does seem like a move to almost clarify that, yes, though Trump once said he was pro-choice, he now opposes abortion. He is saying that he would defund Planned Parenthood. He would nominate anti-choice Supreme Court judges. He once said that women who have an abortion should be punished if it becomes illegal. And we have Pence here who has backed all of that up with actual legislation and a history of doing and saying these things, years and years of it.
Yeah, no. And I wonder, too, Erica, about this. And I think it just touched on this issue of, you know, what a lot of this sort of defunding Planned Parenthood, it's Pence, it's Trump, really means. And I think it's a lot of times people don't get it. And I was I don't know if they don't get it, but maybe not the full scope of it. And I was doing research on this, and I noticed that in Scott County, Indiana, last year, after the Planned Parenthood office in that county was closed down due to declining funding, there was then an HIV outbreak. This is the only place where you could get HIV testing. So, I mean, it really seems that in a lot of ways, it's bigger maybe than a lot of people put it, that we're creating public health crises when we have these people like Mike Pence in these positions of power.
Absolutely. The repercussions of the policies that Mike Pence and Donald Trump have been pushing can be devastating for communities all across the country. As you mentioned, in Scott County, Indiana, really what you're talking about is what was the only HIV testing and treatment center in the county. And what we see is the same kind of thing across the country. You know, when there's no check that Planned Parenthood is getting from the government, defunding is not actually defunding. What it means is blocking patients who rely on federal programs such as Medicaid, such as Title X, and really people who don't have insurance or don't have anywhere else to go from getting care at Planned Parenthood. And that care is basic health care. It's birth control, it's cancer screenings, it's STD testing and treatment, HIV testing and treatment, and even well woman exams.
I mean, it really is. What an unbelievable scope of things that are being attacked. I mean, I wonder, Ali, if it's fair to say, I mean, I say this a lot, but is it fair to say that we have essentially a Jim Crow system for women's reproductive health in this country? It's whether it's geographic or whether it's, and I think Erica was alluding to this, an attack on poor working women.
I would definitely say that you can consider these attacks on poor working women. In places like Indiana, we see that Pence presided over one of the fastest growing HIV outbreaks in rural areas in the U.S. And when asked when he was in Congress about defunding Planned Parenthood and things like HIV testing, he said they ought not to be in the business of providing abortions if they wanted to do that sort of work. So we see his statements on those things affecting rural women, poor women in particular, and him just not caring that much.
Yeah, well, it seems that that is absolutely the case, that he doesn't care that much. The so-called regular guy is how he puts himself. And you know, I wonder, and one of the things I didn't mention, but I did want to go back to about this Indiana bill, this HEA 1337, Ali has said it. It also had a provision in there that doctors would be held criminally liable if an abortion was found to be performed on one of the things that allegedly it was being outlawed. I mean, that seems like a drastic escalation in these kind of laws. Maybe it's not, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, is this something that we can potentially expect to proliferate, especially with someone, you know, in a presidential ticket pushing these sorts of ideas?
Absolutely. And I think you said it best. You know, I think that Donald Trump has kind of jumped beyond dog whistling and has basically been putting into words the policies that a lot of anti-abortion politicians have been pushing. You know, he said himself that he would see women punished for having an abortion. And then, you know, his quote unquote walking back of that line was to say he'd punish doctors. And this is exactly the kind of policy that he's talking about. And it's exactly the kind of thing that we could expect if Donald Trump and Mike Pence were elected.
Well, I think that's certainly absolutely true. I mean, on the first night of the RNC, as part of his quote unquote walk back, as they said, oh, well, we're going to have Melania Trump, his wife, come out and speak to quote unquote women's issues. She did speak, but she didn't say one word about any of that, which certainly speaks to, you know, maybe what they don't want people to know. I mean, I wonder too, Erica, just to follow up on that a little bit. I mean, I think what we've seen around the country recently, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's Fight for 15, whatever it may be, this sort of new movement in the streets that is, you know, somewhat legislative, but also just aimed at maybe shifting cultural beliefs about something. I mean, for abortion rights, women's reproductive health, I mean, the whole, however we want to phrase it, do we need to see, or is it already happening, sort of a renewed movement in the streets in a similar way?
Absolutely. I think it's already happening. You know, yesterday there were people marching in the streets of Cleveland, and it was an anti-poverty march, but we had folks from Planned Parenthood there too, because all of these issues really are connected. You know, here at Planned Parenthood, we, you know, really think about all of the issues that affect our patients' lives. And I think, you know, they're all connected.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're blocking access to reproductive health care, it's an economic issue. When, you know, there is police violence against Black people, you're talking about also the ability to stay safe and live a healthy life. And it's really kind of a holistic approach. And, you know, these agenda issues are always all connected.
Mm-hmm. And Ali, let me ask you this too, because, and as someone who covers this, I don't hear this a lot when it's discussed in the media more broadly. I mean, where do people, voters broadly now, or Americans, whatever, stand when it comes to abortion rights? I mean, sort of the way it's presented now is it's just like two sides and maybe it's 50-50 and who knows who's right. I mean, what do people actually think about these issues?
You know, it's hard to say because of the way that a lot of polls are phrased, but in the media especially, we see a lot of false equivalency between anti-choice and pro-choice groups and what they're saying, when we know that a lot of the times anti-choice groups are using misinformation and debunked myths to talk about abortion. Like I mentioned before, we'll talk about trap laws and clinic regulations. They say they're to help women, but we know that they don't actually help women and that they were actually meant to block abortion care. So really, that issue in the media, I think, is something we're seeing a lot of right now.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, Erica, where you fall on the same question. I mean, how far out of step with people is this Republican ticket?
Oh, completely out of step with the general public. I mean, what we've seen is that for decades, the majority of Americans have actually supported access to safe, legal abortion. And really, this kind of, even for moderate Republicans, a majority of them, the people who self-identify as moderate Republicans, support access to abortion and support access to care of Planned Parenthood. And actually, they're so out of step with the general public that it's something that will likely cost them in the election. What we've seen from poll after poll is that when politicians oppose care at Planned Parenthood, when politicians say they want to, quote unquote, defund Planned Parenthood, and especially as Mike Pence and Donald Trump have said that they want to shut down the government to prevent patients from getting care at Planned Parenthood.
Well, for sure. I think that sentiment is, I mean, it's real. I saw actually in Politico magazine just this past week, there was actually an article, it was a roundtable with a bunch of Republicans who were talking about what is the future post-Trump. And Katie Packer, who's a pretty prominent Republican strategist. She heads one of the anti-Trump PACs out there. She was actually saying that one of the biggest liabilities for Republicans is the fact that even amongst women she's talking to who are on the right, defunding Planned Parenthood seems too extreme. So, Ali, let me ask you this. I mean, is it possible that as outrageous as so much of what Mike Pence is saying and what Trump is saying is, that it could actually have the opposite effect of what they're hoping and start to maybe reorient how people feel about these issues because it's so extreme, it creates a whole new line of discussion?
I think at the very least, we are creating these discussions where we might not have seen them before. This is a huge election issue. If Trump hadn't selected Pence, who's to say how much of an election issue it would be? Of course, it matters, and a lot of people are talking about it, but this has really propelled it into the national spotlight in a giant way, and it could make a huge impact for voters.
No, absolutely. And I mean, is this an issue, though? And I guess maybe this is my question, and going back to something that Erica said and alluding to what you said about how these the polls are done and things like that. I mean, are media outlets really, I guess the mainstream ones, doing their due diligence in the way they should be to report this? Because I think that's, again, and I mentioned this earlier, always my frustration is I feel like it's presented as if there's just like two sides to this issue and that there's no facts involved. But when in fact, there's actually quite a bit of science and facts on one side, but not the other.
Yeah, we see that science and facts fall firmly on pro-choice values. Science doesn't support 20-week abortion bans based on fetal pain, things of that nature. So we see that, and we don't always see that represented in the media saying, well, the pro-choice people say this, but anti-choice people argue this, kind of presents this balance that doesn't say what is actually true. If science and evidence points firmly to one position, it's important to note that.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. Although I guess, as many of our listeners know, that is not a new reality in the Republican Party. Perhaps they are just scientifically challenged, reproductive rights, climate change. It just seems just about everything. Black Lives Matter. I mean, they're just throwing stuff out there without any sort of facts, any way, shape, or form. And perhaps we're in a similar situation here. But that's going to do it for this segment. And thank you so much to Erica Sacken, who's the Director of Political Communications at Planned Parenthood Action Fund, and Ali Bogan, Political and Campaigns Editor at Rewire.news. Thank you both so much for joining us. And this is By Any Means Necessary. I'm Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about what a Vice President Pence could mean for labor and a little bit about his record in the state of Indiana, where, as many of you may know, he was governor. And we are very, very happy to be joined by phone by Haley Brannon, who's the Director of Communications at the Indiana AFL-CIO. Haley, thank you so much for being with us.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. And so as the RNC rolls on here, Mike Pence, especially in the lead up to his rollout, the big deal about him was that he was a quote unquote regular guy. He went to Chili's with his family after the announcement with Trump and all of that. But then I've also seen an interesting counterpoint in a lot of media stories about him, that he is, in fact, one of the darlings of the Koch network and all these rich right-wing donors, which doesn't sound like something a regular person does. So I don't know, what is the true narrative? Is he just sort of a regular aw shucks guy, or is he really a front for these type of corporate Koch brother interests?
Absolutely. No, he is definitely not the persona that he plays off as this regular, middle town kind of guy. He is a proud member of the American Legislative Exchange Council, which I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they are, it's a group of corporate lobbyists who make their way to the state legislators and basically wine and dine them and introduce anti-worker legislation to these people. So Mike Pence is a front runner of ALEC. He's a proud member. He's actually speaking at their national convention that will be taking place in Indianapolis next weekend. So, yeah, definitely friendly with the Koch brothers and friendly with the Alec people as well.
Well, that's certainly something, that this audience knows a lot about. And certainly for those who may be wondering, Alec, American Legislative Exchange, also been very active on private prisons and other issues like that. And I wonder, you know, there were so few people who wanted to be the Republican vice presidential candidate, and most of them were just sort of random, also rans, washed up people. Mike Pence, sitting governor, somewhat, you know, popular guy. And I wonder why he would just jump out of his reelection race in Indiana into what potentially could be, I mean, we'll have to see, but what potentially could be the sinking ship of a Trump campaign. I mean, is he just trying to save his reputation before he loses the election, or what could be going on here?
Yeah, from our understanding, Pence is trailing in the polls to his Democratic challenger, John Gregg, in this election, who he narrowly beat in 2012. So since in the past 4 years, Pence has completely, you know, failed Hoosiers with his leadership in the state as governor. And so I think that he is running away from, or maybe more so, he's avoiding his defeat in this election. He's definitely, I think, trying to keep his stardom alive and as a politician and in the Republican Party, because he has disappointed his fellow Republicans in the Hoosier state. And so now this is his desperate attempt for everyone around the country who doesn't know his record here in Indiana to kind of play on that and look like the good guy, the good Republican.
Right, for sure. Well, and you mentioned his record in Indiana. So, I mean, touching a little bit on that, I know one of the big things that has been happening, it happened under his predecessor, Miss Daniels, Mike Pence is really 100% all about it, is this idea of right to work. And Donald Trump, his running mate, says, I'm 100% right to work. I mean, can you just say from an Indiana perspective, I mean, what has the right to work law done for working people there?
Right. So, you know, as a statewide federation of labor unions, this has really hurt our members and our labor unions across the state, because it is allowing non-members to basically reap the benefits of what a union is all about, what they represent. And so they're able to be in on the collective bargaining. They're allowed to file a grievance, but they are not required by Indiana law with this right to work law to pay their union membership dues, which, you know, that's so, as I said, they're reaping the benefits of this service, if you will, without actually paying into it. So they're, you know, they're freeloading off of this.
And I guess if it's not that surprising, since Pence is not the biggest fan of unions, that he also apparently is not much of a fan of the minimum wage. He actually said in a quote that increasing the minimum wage to $7.25 an hour, $7.25, he said that it will, and I quote, it will harm both the wage payer and the wage earner. An excessive increase in the minimum wage will hurt the working poor. So I wonder, as someone who works with working people and the working poor in Indiana, what do you think about that statement?
Yeah, that's absolutely ridiculous, and it's entirely untrue. When we look at the difference in, or the income inequality being the highest that it's ever been, how can someone sit there and say that increasing the minimum wage from, in Indiana, there was a proposal to raise it just a dollar from $7.25 to $8.25, and he was against that as well. How can you be a cheerleader for something that, you know, doesn't, if he's all about the Indiana economy, boosting the economy, I mean, these people can't even live on the wages that they're earning, and seeing how much of a pay gap there is between the top 1% and the 99% and the middle class completely shrinking. I mean, I think what that says about him is that he doesn't care about the working families of Indiana. He doesn't care about the middle class worker. He mainly cares about the corporations and sending all of the money to the top 1% and forgetting about the people who actually built this nation,
mm-hmm.
the middle class earner, mm-hmm. the working family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's sort of a related issue to this, as it's, you know, perhaps that Governor Pence doesn't care about the minimum wage. It appears people in Indiana, though, care to some extent. And I say that because there is a state law there that banned localities from being able to set a minimum wage or paid sick days that's above what the state or the federal government does, which seems to me, now tell me if I'm wrong, that that really is just an attempt to prevent the places where people are more willing to act on the minimum wage from doing anything. So he's someone who's going to come run around and say, I'm a champion of states' rights and people should decide their own stuff for the whole next 4 or 5 months, is someone who is acting also to limit the ability of localities to make any changes to minimum wages. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, that's absolutely a correct statement, yes. And by all means, very fair to what his rhetoric is. So yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there with that one.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, is the fight for 15, I've seen it's active in Indianapolis in general. I mean, is this something that's catching on a little bit in Indiana?
You know, out of our office, we have the Unite Here, who they are the organizing, the field organizers who are fighting for this $15 minimum wage. And honestly, it hasn't caught fire necessarily. It is something that our organization is working very hard to move in the state. I don't think a lot of people in Indiana have really paid much attention to the fight for 15, you know, mainly because we have such a Republican-controlled political agenda here in Indiana that the rhetoric, everything they're seeing, the messaging is that, you know, our wages are too high, that we don't need this spike in the minimum wage, and that I think that people are just very misled, and I think that that they have been misled because of the political agenda that has been put in place by the Republicans of the state, who are very strongly opposed to the fight for 15.
And let me pick up on that a little bit, because I think the issue, I mean, it's certainly raised here. I mean, Mike Pence obviously is the governor. Previously, you had Mitch Daniels was the governor. You just said there's a lot of Republican control. So I think, I mean, what kind of tactics are these people using to win these elections that, I mean, perhaps at least will make themselves seen in this presidential election campaign from a Vice President Pence?
Well, I think something that Mike Pence had really harped on in his campaign, and also something after his, you know, failed attempt at governorship in the past 4 years that he's really tried to bring to light in his reelection campaign, is that Indiana's economy is on the rise. Well, Indiana's economy, you know, we may be bringing more jobs in, but the wages aren't going up. People aren't earning more income. It's just as stagnant as it always has been. And so by him playing on the fact that our economy is improving because there are more jobs and there's more productivity, that isn't necessarily saying that the people in Indiana, the working families, are making livable wages and are able to get ahead. Indiana is far behind in income across the board. I mean, compared to all of the other states, Indiana is very low to the bottom in that. And I think that to kind of mask that, Pence and other Republicans before him have really played on the economy improving when really wages have just gone down or stayed the same.
Right. I mean, it's almost like a bait and a switch, right? It's sort of like, well, we're going to bring in all these jobs, but since the wages are so much lower, it doesn't have that much of an impact. And, you know, I don't know if Pence is this kind of governor. I know Robert Bentley, who's the governor, Republican governor in Alabama for some time, he used to make a similar claim, but it also turned out the way that a lot of these jobs were even coming there, where they were just giving these huge tax breaks to these big corporations so that, I mean, not only did the jobs pay less, but that it actually cost the same people who are getting paid less more money out of their taxes to bring it in there. So it's like you're subsidizing your own low-wage job. I don't know if that's also how Pence has lured some of these businesses to Indiana in your experience.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think one prime example that we can look at is the Carrier plant that just recently announced that they're going to be moving their current operations to Monterrey, Mexico by 2017. If this doesn't say a lot about Pence's negativity towards unions, the workers there who had been working, you know, 30 plus years in this plant were making wages, you know, averaging about $30 an hour with a, you know, total health benefit packages and retirement plans. Well, in February, after Carrier was granted a $1.5 million in tax incentives by the city of Indianapolis, they announced 1 year later that they were going to move their business or their entire operation to Mexico, where workers were going to make $3 an hour without benefits. The local union, it would be under the United Steelworkers, Local 1999 here in Indianapolis, they tried to negotiate with Governor Pence and with the state by cutting wages $25 million. And so Carrier came back and said you'd have to cut $65 million in wages, and your workers would have to work without health insurance and without any benefits at all. So Pence just kind of let that one slide. And if that doesn't say his, you know, dedicated he is to the workers of Indiana, then I don't know what does.
No, I hear you. I just wonder, as the counterpoint, perhaps, I mean, and this is what perhaps Pence would say, is, well, these $30 an hour salaries, they're just not competitive in the global marketplace. So the plant would close either as nothing you could do about it. And so workers need to adjust their sights downward. I mean, I think that's going to be a lot of the rhetoric we hear in the campaign. I wonder how you respond to that.
He's playing on the emotions of people at that point. And it's not fair for him to say, hey, your wages are just too high. And so in order for us to stay competitive, we're going to have to move your jobs. We're just going to leave you high and dry. I think that's incredibly disheartening to all working families across the nation. I mean, I just don't think that rhetoric will fly with a lot of working class people. But then again, he has managed to win over the votes of a lot of working families in the state. And so I think that will probably be one of his tactics. But then again, he will probably have to go through Donald Trump's campaign. And as we know, there are a few things that they disagree on, and global trade is one of them.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder how you maybe see that playing out, because obviously the big sort of meme in the media is, well, Pence and Trump are kind of an odd couple and they balance each other out. But I saw you guys also put out a statement that said that it wasn't super surprising that Pence and Trump could link up since they had some identity around things like right to work. I mean, how do you expect that to play out in the campaign moving forward?
Well, I think that Trump is no friend of workers either. He spent millions of dollars trying to prevent his workers in his casinos and his hotels from unionizing, said that he's 100% right to work. I think that the rhetoric is very consistent there. I think the issue they're going to run into, you know, Donald Trump has tried to appeal to our membership in particular, and luckily the majority of them are smart enough to see around that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's harping on these frustrations that these trade deals are taking our jobs overseas, and I'm going to stop that. But, you know, I think that having Mike Pence on board, someone who is very pro-trade, I think that Donald Trump is going to move his position on that. And it's going to get those people who are on board with Trump right now, because he just kind of flies by the seat of his pants and says whatever is going to get him a vote. I think and I hope that will get those people to think about where his loyalties lie, and if he's really being truthful and standing up for his morals and what he's been spouting off this entire campaign.
Mm-hmm. And so in Indiana, where you are, I mean, is the key battleground, and this is the last question, is the key battleground in this election where you are in Indiana going to be really on this issue of trade and jobs? I mean, is it going to be almost a singular election?
You know, yeah, I really do, because I've seen and heard so many of our members really jump on the Trump train because he has been vocal against trade deals. And I think that is going to be a key battleground there. And I think if Pence can get him to flip on that, then he's going to lose some voters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's going to do it for us today. Special thanks to Haley Brandon from the Indiana AFL-CIO. She's the communications director there, telling us a little bit about Mike Pence. And you've been listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.